the UCR Podcast.
The Judas Priest Rock and Roll album turned 50 last year, and they celebrated that milestone by having longtime Priest producer Tom Allum oversee a new remix of the record. And honestly, I like the remix for certain reasons, while the other part of me is glad that the original mix is still out there for us to easily enjoy as well. But what is important about all of this is that they are finally able to shine a light on two of the more obscure albums in the catalog that fans and musicians alike have really loved for a lot of years. There was always this frustration that Rockarola and the Sad Wings of Destiny album were in the background and in the far distance compared to the rest of their body of work. Now, those two albums are finally getting their due, and it's been great to see. Founding guitarist KK Downing surprised fans yesterday by putting out a new version of the song Never Satisfied from Rockarola, and we were pleased to be able to share that song with Ultimate Classic Rock listeners on Friday night's show. Today on the podcast, you'll hear the conversations I had with KK, as well as vocalist Tim Ripper Owens, about their collaboration on this new version of Never Satisfied. I spoke with the two of them separately earlier this week, and it was fun to get some fan perspective from Ripper about Rockarola, and I also enjoyed hearing some insights about the original song and album from KK. Speaking of Tom Allum, if you go back in the podcast archives here, you'll be able to find a conversation I had last fall about that remix of Rockarola. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, make sure to follow us so that you will get future episodes as they are released. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review it. Here are our conversations with KK Downing and Ripper Owens. Enjoy. Well, it is so cool that you have this new version of Never Satisfied. And obviously fans first heard this song for the first time as part of Rockarola back in the day. But KK, this is a song that you co-wrote originally with Al Atkins. So let's start there. Like, take us back to how the song took shape back then when you and Al wrote it.
Yeah, it was a long, long time ago, wasn't it? I mean, in the late 60s, I guess, and was very early days. Such a long time ago, but yeah, we just had fun in a spare bedroom, just trying to create something different, a bit unique, and we had fun doing it. And yeah, we wrote quite a lot of stuff, myself and Al, and then we went on the road and was gigging around. And And I say Never Satisfied was always, from my memory, was always in the set. You know, then when Al left and Rob joined, you know, we were on the road for at least a couple of years. And, I know we had that song in the set with Rob singing it as well. And obviously it was on the album along with the other songs. I guess I could have redone, had a go at any one of the songs, Matt, you know, but it kind of just jumped out as, you know, just basically pick one and that one came out of the hat, you know. I guess probably because the length of it, the groove of it, and I think that it's one of those songs that has definitely stood the test of time. And so, When I started to play the remixed and the remastered album, I thought, you know, I'm just going to plug the guitar in and just got to have a go at, you know, jamming along to a couple of these songs. And so I just had fun doing it. And I thought I would put the track down and ask Ripper if he would just do me the courtesy of throwing a vocal on there. And it all came about really quite quick. And it was fun. And I thought, well, you know, the guys from Reach Publishing now have the sole rights to those two first records. And very graciously, they've included us, which I say is, you know, we're all so pleased now to feel that the albums have come home to us. And so now I think it's time to, you know, catch up a little bit. And let's re-record some of these songs. And I said to the guys, obviously, you've totally kept the integrity of the original recordings with the new mixes and masters. But I think, let me just plug in the guitar and let me just think of it me today, 50 years on, let me just put it down and do it how I would if I was going out on the road with probably tomorrow. And that might well happen.
Ah, that'd be cool. It sounds like you have a desire to kind of like record more of this stuff. Have you done any others already?
I have actually done, just for the sake of it, this was going back last year, if not the year before. I was thinking, you know, because when you're thinking of set lists and stuff like that, I actually did play along with a couple of tracks and press record and thought, you know, one day it might be nice to include these in our repertoire. And I'm sure it's going to happen now that the records have come home, you know, and we feel very much a part of the records. As you would expect us to, really, as though they'd never been away. So we'll have to see what happens.
What I love, KK, is I love hearing you. I love seeing that in the press materials about how you just talked about it, things really being kind of casual, you just plugging in and starting to play along with it. And so what you just kind of spoke to was the idea of putting yourself back into it as the guitar player that you are now. And that is what I found interesting listening to the remixed version of Rockarola last year when that came out. As I was revisiting that today, Deep Freeze is just a 2-minute instrumental from that record that is just an insane showcase of your guitar skills at that point. And so I wonder, like, what do you hear personally when you listen to your playing from that time? It's got to be really interesting.
It's a bit, it was really weird because I guess what used to happen, Matt, is I used to do this bit of insane guitar solo. You know, that was back in the days, late 60s, early 70s. Like all the bands all do solos. The drummer, the bass player, Ian did a solo as well in the set. I did a solo, you know, so it was basically par for the course back then. But anyway, I used to do this basically controlled and uncontrolled feedback. And it was lengthy, but there was some very melodic stuff in there as well, you know, which ended up on Rockarola, some of the melodic stuff from my guitar solo ended up on the record, which was cool. But let's say it was a long improvised solo, a bit of madness, a lot of theatrics going on. But obviously when I got in the studio on my own and I was meant to be doing it, I didn't say I froze. That's not where the title came from, you know, Winter Deep Freeze. But it was kind of a sense of that. I think, you know, where's the audience? You know, how can I perform without the audience? And it was a bit kind of weird. But anyway, I did my best and came up with that. And I must tell you the story that goes on from that. When we were doing famous story, Sad Wings of Destiny, and I was doing the solo for Victim of Changes, the ad-lib solo. The very famous producer and wonderful gentleman, Chris Tangarides, who was working as a tape op and T-boy at Morgan Studios when I was doing that, he told me that he could hear all of this noise coming out of the studio when I was doing that on my own, that solo, laying that down, that track, and he had the door open. And he said that I was throwing the guitar down and doing all this as I was live on stage. And to be honest, I would have been doing that, you know, because just getting in the moment and stuff. And he went to his boss and says, he said the F word. He says, can I work with that band? You know, and he did. He came into the studio and he got the job as a tape op and T-boy on the album, Chris Tangarides, the great Chris Tangarides. And of course, he went on to be what he came to be. But Chris was a good player, a guitar player. He played in a band in those early days. And he showed me photographs of him as a young, slim guy, good-looking guy, playing guitar in Korea in his band. You know, so he was a massive fan, obviously. So I just thought I'd tell you that story because, bless him, you know, we remember him with great fondness.
I'm glad to hear you say all that, KK, because I think that it can sometimes be difficult for musicians to look back at, you know, in this case, what is their first album, their first kind of work. But it's just like, you feel when I listen to Rockarola as an album, it feels like you're pretty fully formed or pretty far along the way as a player for what's represented on record. So one thing that you can look at that you've talked about here in these past few minutes is just the idea that, like, you guys have been playing so much. You guys have been doing so much road work that it seems like that must have helped in a sense, because you did have a certain kind of comfort level with the instrument because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like I say, it was just one of those things. It was those early days are so critical, aren't they, to a band? They're absolutely essential. And then it's such, because actually you don't realize, because you're a band, you don't have a recording contract, and you're out there and you're touring and you're working hard and you're writing songs and you're doing all of this. But you don't realize until you actually make a record and it's out there in the public, that's when everything steps up to another level. And you have to be very careful because you get caught up in the business, you know. And so you've got to be careful, I think, just to make sure that nothing takes away from who you are and what you are and what you're trying to be and all your aspirations, you know, and your creativity. You've got to keep a hold of that as much as you can. You know, it can't be watered down, diluted and diffused in any way. You've got to keep that work up. And I think we did that, you know. So basically that helped us to go forward as opposed to go backwards. The only way we went backwards is we lost control and contact of the music that we'd spent so much time creating, really, with the first two records, because of all of the legal jargon, legal side of it. I mean, none of those songs really, for a long time, ended up in our live set. You know, it was. But when they did, we said, look, we're just going to have to do this. We know that we're not going to make any money from this, but, you know, songs like The Ripper and Victim of Changes. Yeah, we've got to put those songs in the set. And to be honest, it seems like they were always in the set. But yet, you have to be very careful because you're learning and learning and trying to better yourself. And being a musician, you know, you've got to continue to learn. For so often, you learn enough to get you by and then you kind of stop, you know. It's like learning the English language. We probably learn about 20% of the vocabulary as what's in the Oxford English Dictionary. But 80% of all of those words, we never go anywhere near, do we? You know, we can order a beer and, you know, and we can do what we need to do and we stop. But we, as a musician, you've got to carry on and keep on learning. And so now, I'm still learning and still learning, and it'll never stop. It's a massive, massive language to learn.
It must have been hard at the time to, like, lose, in a sense, those two albums. But it's like, at the same time, like, you guys are just on this incredible, like, treadmill of work. The story of Judas Priest is just going album by album, tour by tour, like, how much did you feel that disconnection from those two records at the time? Because it becomes, of course, for us as fans, it becomes a legendary divide. Like, in a sense, it's like these guys have these two albums in their catalog that they don't really acknowledge. Why don't they do that? You know, so it was difficult for fans. And so hearing you talk as you just did, like, that's extraordinarily difficult for you all as the creators to have lost those two records the way you did.
Yeah. I think we were so, felt so dejected and unhappy about what had happened, I think, because we really felt that we had so much to give, you know, and we offered that, you know, and it wasn't accepted. So we had to move on. We had no choice. We had to move on. And that's what we did. I guess we felt really quite angry about it, Matt. You know, we felt quite angry about what had happened to us. You know, we didn't want to be detached from those records. But, you know, fair play to us. At some point, we said, let's just forget about it. We've got to take these songs. We've got to play some of these songs, even though it's for somebody else's benefit, because all the revenue, 100%, goes to them. But we manned up, and fair play to us. That's what we did, you know. But then again, I suppose we had the last laugh in a sense, because everything that we promised, we delivered up for a great set of people, to be honest, that put everything behind Judas Priest. Sony did everything. We had all of the support and the belief that we needed. And that a band really needs that, you know, encouragement and belief, you know. Sometimes you need that to keep making you go out there and keep writing and working hard and pushing for better things, because we felt we had a duty to pay back, really, you know, Sony as a label, really, what they had given to us, all of this belief, and we felt that we needed to continue to keep up the work ethic and to be as successful as we could, you know, because they expected it of us, I think, really, and quite rightfully so. But fair play to them. They actually saw that we had something special, and they supported that and always did and still do today.
It's super exciting, KK, that one, that you've had that relationship the way you have over the years with Sony. Like, that was certainly a key part of Judas Priest, and also to see things kind of come full circle as they have with the remix of Rockarola. And it's like, you know, there's the remix of Sad Wings that is in the works, and, like, you know, based on what I heard from Rockarola, I cannot wait to see what we're going to get from Sad Wings. And I think that it's really good and really appropriate. And what you just said about Sony, we could also say a similar thing about Tom Allum, because Tom really understands the sound of Judas Priest. So I think it's very appropriate that he's been the one that's been helping you guys to oversee kind of the reimagined versions of these two albums. At this point, like, how much have you heard of the Sad Wing stuff that's coming together at this point?
I haven't really at this point, but it's work in progress now. But on Rockarola, it was a fantastic day, to be honest. I went down to the studio in London, you know, to see how the guys were getting on, and all the original tapes were there, and I was able to listen to the guys, what they were doing. I guess they were just looking for me to give it a thumbs up, which I did. I said, absolutely, you guys are bringing out all of these ambiences and these nuances, and you can virtually hear our breaths as we are all together in that room laying the tracks down. But the important thing is to keep the integrity of the album, and that's what the guys did. Obviously, as we moved on to Sad Wings, we had progressed, technology had progressed, and techniques had progressed, and we were determined to make that, obviously, louder, heavier, you know, and everything else that goes with it. I too have got some good expectations to come from that, and I'm looking forward to going down again, meeting up with Tom again and the guys, and seeing how they're getting on.
Absolutely, man. And just generally, like, what do you appreciate about what kind of Tom Allum brought to Judas Priest over the years as you guys were working with him?
Well, Tom, he was everything, wasn't he, really? First of all, Tom's a really good musician. He was great with harmonies and vocal stuff, and obviously. Tom was a great all-rounder, you know. Plus, he had to be often the referee.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of disagreements happening. Recorded, you're there together, you're working with something. Yeah, I think it's too loud. No, it's not loud enough. And, you know, I think that guitar sound needs more distortion. No, it doesn't. And it's a million things. So you need somebody in there to put the divide down and go, okay, guys, you know, let's chill out. Let's have a beer and come back tomorrow and have a listen there. So, yeah, but Tom, essentially, out of everybody put together, I just think it's fair to say that he deserves the accolade of putting the sound of Judas Priest together for sure.
You know, you talked earlier about writing in a bedroom with Al Atkins, and those early days of doing that are so formative and so special. How do you think that that helped you once you subsequently got into a writing relationship with Rob and with Glenn?
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I think the one thing is that I was really pleased that Al, because Al really did have his roots set in the blues, you know, and that's where he came from. But obviously, when I came along, I, as much as I really loved the blues, it wasn't where I wanted to go, because I was more, you know, Cream and Hendrix and more of the progressive side. But I wasn't really that interested in progressive blues. I think, I guess now what I was looking for was progressing more of the heavy stuff, really. So it was enjoyable because everything that we were doing was breaking new ground. It was. Because when we were booked out as Judas Priest with Al Atkins on the mic, people didn't know what we were doing. So they just booked us as a progressive blues band, always. That's what they did. Because we didn't have a label for our style of music, which was okay, because I didn't know what it was either. I only know that I was kind of intent on doing what I could hear in my mind and my imagination, and that's it. You know, I didn't know that it was always going to be heavy metal, but it was. I only kind of just took my influences from certain things that I heard that I liked, you know, and now I know now and realize those things that I did like were more than hard rock or heavy rock. They were more heavy metal. I mean, a good example would be when I first heard the song called You Really Got Me by the Kinks. That would be about 1965, 66, something like that. And I really loved that song because I really loved that riff, because it wasn't a 12-bar riff. It wasn't blues. It wasn't progressive blues. And then when I saw Van Halen in 1978 supporting Black Sabbath in Birmingham, my hometown, and Eddie came out with that guitar and he starts playing that riff, I'm thinking, that's why I like that song all of those years ago, you know, because listen to it now, you know. So that was one of the first things I was really kind of really into. I was into anything that was a bit more kind of moody and a bit more edgy and a bit more. And of course, when Hendrix came along with Purple Haze and Foxy Lady, that was it. That was really heavy metal to me, even though it didn't have a label at the time, but that changed my life. You know, those songs did, because I knew that there was a style out there, you know. And then I was starting to listen to some other more obscure stuff, you know, like, you know, bands like Quatermass and them, the Pretty Things, and everything that was a bit kind of out of the ordinary. I went on from there. When Barry McGuire came out with Eve of Destruction, I'm thinking, why do I like this? I really like this. It's just so different, and it's kind of, and it's moody, and it's eclectic, and I like it, you know. And the lyrics meant a lot to me, you know. I didn't really know what the song was about, but I just thought it's kind of it attracts me in some way, you know. So that's all I can say. That's what I was all about, just doing stuff that was, you know, that much different. And we just got on with it. And Al was totally on board with doing that. Fair play to him. He totally took to it. And that's when we came up with, you know, versions of what became Victim of Changes and all of those songs that we did, which most of it ended up on, not all of it, but most of it ended up on Rock and Roll.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the whole Van Halen thing, because it's like Eddie heard the Kinks and that's what he did with it. So there's context, and it's like, and everything that you just talked about, them, the Pretty Things, all the bands that you named off, like, I know that you have said that Judas Priest was in an interesting spot as a band, even trying to get a record contract, because there was already Black Sabbath, there was already Led Zeppelin, there was already Deep Purple. So it's like there were, if we look at it from a contextual standpoint, not only the stuff that you guys were listening to, but also the stuff that was coming along, not even coming along, but like, those three bands, Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, that were already having major success, it gives you a lot to process going into making your own album. So as we see as music fans, like what you detailed with Van Halen, like, you know, you people as creatives, like you take all that stuff and you process it in such an interesting way. So that really kind of gives us an interesting thing to look at all these years later, doesn't it?
Exactly that. That's why we're all kind of different. You know, musically, we're all kind of different. We're all different because I was listening to, you know, anything that wasn't derived from the blues, really. And that's what, because I was listening to, like, well, obviously when Budgie came along, I love that. And Skid Row, the first Skid Row.
Sure.
You know, with Gary Moore. I loved it. You know, I loved it. And I was a big fan of Deep Purple because so much of their stuff wasn't really derived from the blues. I think they were the first, probably the first out and out rock band, I think, that I heard, because their rock music was absolutely astounding because it came from them. I like that, you know. And then, of course, when the first Black Sabbath album came out, I think suddenly I was thinking, thank heavens for that. You know, there's other people, like-minded people around. It sounded different, but kind of we swam together, you know. And at least, you know, that was great, really, because, like I say, I loved the blues and I went to see all of the blues artists. I did, you know. But that great bands, even Cream, Led Zeppelin, they were, you know, and it's now we do know now, obviously, Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page, they must have spent hours and hours learning, you know, all of those blues tracks. But I didn't, you know, I kind of skipped that, you know, went on to doing other things that wasn't derived from the blues, you know. So, and look at us now. What a great life I've had and a great career and a great journey. You know, to have been a part of that road that came, you know, we had the blues, progressive blues and rock and progressive rock. Then we had hard rock, heavy rock, and heavy metal. But like I say, way, way back then when you were doing stuff, there wasn't much around, really. But I'm glad I'm so fortunate to have been born when I was born, Matt, you know, 1951. What a great year that was. It could have been 50, it could have been 52 or thereabouts, but to have grown up and see it all come together, you know, because when I was growing up as a youngster, very early, the blues artists weren't in the country. You know, but they started to come and they started to play, and it was such a big influence on so many great guitar players and great musicians. But like I say, I stepped in, you know, very early on. I loved the blues, but I had my ear out for other things, and yeah. Because there wasn't enough of it, or, you know, very little. I'm thinking, I want to create more because there's got to be other people out there like me that want that alternative.
Well, KK, it is always so wonderful to speak with you. I will let you run on to the next thing, but I know that we'll be talking again before we know it about some sort of music. You always have something percolating. So thank you always for the time, man.
It's a pleasure, Matt. Anytime. Always good to speak to you. And let's do it again sometime.
Well, I love that you and Ken got a chance to do this version of Never Satisfied. For you, you're like, choose your own Judas Priest adventure. That had to be pretty cool for you getting to like go in and sing this song.
Yeah, I've been, you know, hounding him for a long time to do something from Rock. When we were doing KK's Priest ideas, I said, why don't even re-record it? This was back, you know, before they reissued Rock and Roll. And obviously now they've reissued it, so that's why we're doing this, I think. But I've been trying to get him to do it. You know, because first of all, I said, Ken, you wrote those songs. Some of them you wrote by yourself, and then you and Al wrote some of the other ones. So it's kind of like a cool thing that you just take the ones, you know, you wrote them anyways. I was excited to do it because it's, you know, I don't have to change a lot singing. You know, I sing it my style. You can hear it in the version of the song. It's still me singing it, but staying true to the melodies. I changed a little bit, add a little bit of rasp, some high notes. But that's what's great about singing Judas Priest songs is that's just kind of how I sing. I mean, that's part of my style, right? It's part of it. I sing a little more aggressive at times, but that's how my voice is. And man, I want to do more. I said, Ken, let's record the whole damn thing. I don't care. Let's have fun. I think that's what's happened finally. He was under pressure. He wanted to do KK's Priest. We put out two amazing records. The last one was just unbelievable. The tours were great. I think he's just starting to think, let me just have some fun, man. Let me just do some stuff. I'm there. I'm there for the fun. Just call me, Ken. You want to do a rock and roll? Okay. You want to do Run of the Mill? You want to do Cheater? I've always wanted to do Cheater because I've always felt the guitar, you know, with more balls nowadays. I'm not playing the harmonica in it though, but I think it's fun. I think he's kind of just having some fun. I think there'll be some more coming, I hope.
I think he's earned the right to have fun because, like I was telling him, we talked a little bit ago, but it's just like listening to that instrumental on Rock-A-Rolla, Deep Freeze, like that is just insane guitar playing for somebody that is making their first record with a band. It's hard to fathom that that's what he was doing on album one with Judas Priest.
And I don't think people, I think people understood it once they heard KK's Priest, the importance of KK Downing in Judas Priest. I think when they heard these records, they went, oh shit. Cause people would make the dumb comments like, well, that sounds like Judas Priest. Well, it, you know, he did write for only Judas Priest for 50 years. But you nailed it on that. Ken, he wrote basically pretty much that record, right? I mean, that was his music at that time. And then Al Atkins and Rob. But I mean, really, you think of, and you can tell by listening to it, can't you? You can tell by, and you're right, man. I mean, I think all those songs should go into the KK's Priest set list, man. I mean, that's why when we bust into Sinner live or Victim of Changes, both of those songs, and he has that long solo, you know, I was my idea to say, why don't we, obviously not the drummer, but let's leave the stage, just let Ken stand in the middle of the stage and just do his thing, man. And when I introduce Sinner live, I always go, some people call him, it might be, this is kind of a cheesy heavy metal way to do it, some people call him Mr. Downing. I call him Mr. Sinner because that's, and he comes out and's like, I mean, I tell you, those guys, Glenn and Ken, inspiration and guitar players. But Ken's inspiration, I think, goes beyond anything, man. It's just unbelievable.
For you as a fan, where were you in your journey as a Priest fan when you first heard Rock-A-Rolla?
Later. I became a Priest fan. I heard songs from him, but my brother got Screaming for Vengeance and I got REO Speedwagon's High Infidelity. And I was like, look at those guys, you know, Rob's, you know, the back of the, you know, that grainy photo on Screaming for Vengeance where I'm like, look at those guys. And I heard Electric Eye and that was it. I mean, that was it for me. And then I went back and became little bit of a fanatic back then, really, you know, because that's all I would listen to is Judas Priest. I would take my albums to choir in high school and go, listen, we should do Last Rose of Summer or Dissident Aggressor. And I love rock and roll. I gotta be honest. I hate to say this, but I think I like the original recording even better than the remastered remix recording, but I love the record, man. I love the sound of it. It's got that nostalgia. I was playing for somebody, my brother yesterday, the original, or my daughter, the original, my version of Never Satisfied. Then I played the original. And they're like, wow, that is a difference. You could tell that version's from the 70s, and that same song that you did sounds like it's from nowadays, even though it's the same song. And that's what's cool about rock and roll, right? It's got that great, you know, I know people won't like the mix, but yeah, it's just great stuff. And I was glad when he called and said, hey, do you think you'd be interested in singing? I'm like, yeah, of course I would.
Even the original album before they remixed it and, you know, put that out last year, like, sometimes you hear a band's first record and the band's first record doesn't even sound good. Like, that's got a really respectable sound for what they captured in the studio back then. Like, it's the songs are good. Like, I really like the record.
It's a different vibe and it's really cool. And I'm into the, you know, it's got more of the spacey, groovy, you know, what did Ken say? He might have sent you, you know, what did they used to call them? When they weren't called hard rock, heavy metal at first. It was called something else.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, progressive blues type stuff.
Yeah, it was they were labeled as that on posters and everything, you know, kind of. Yeah. And yeah, it's really fun. I really hope. I hope we do. I have a feeling this one will be in the next set list. And I hope so, because they're pretty easy to sing, to be honest, too. So they're a lot easier to sing than Hellfire Thunderbolt and Sermons of the Sinner and things like that. So I'm looking forward to putting some of those in there. I just say we make an album with, I was going to say Ken's favorites, but then it'll never have any of my songs in it. We'll have some Rippers and Ken's favorites, and then we'll have some from Demolition and Jugulator. And, you know, Rock-a-Rolla and, you know, the whole history of it. I say, let's make a record that's got two songs from our favorite records. And it'd be fun. It's fun to do it. You know, like I said, I think Ken's having fun. He's doing these things. You know, two things about it. You want to have fun and you got to know it's a business. So that's the two things to make sure. And it was fun doing this. It came out great. The mix they sent me, I loved it. I was like, all right, nicely done.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. And I mean, it wasn't your first time doing it. Obviously, like when you were in Priest, like, you know, you guys, you know, did updated versions of Green Mile Alesi and Rapid Fire. So it seems like that would probably give you some interesting context for going in and doing something like this, because you had done it before.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, one thing is, you know, we did updated versions, but a lot of those songs I was already singing kind of anyways.
Sure.
Diamonds and Rust, we changed completely. From their version, we went back to more like Joan Baez version. Green Man Alesi, like you said, we made it even different. We slowed it down. Now win the dig. And then Rapid Fire I made a chorus, Rapid Fire, which is not even in the song. But that was live. But, you know, it's fun doing. I think if you redo it, you go back and do some obscure stuff. That's why I wanted to do this, is what I've always said to Ken. Let's do Cheater or some of these songs. And a matter of fact, this was the one I said I wanted to put in the set list. And the reason why, again, I said that was because Ken and Al wrote the song. So I thought it was, you know, we didn't have to deal with any, you know, whatever. So I thought, let's just put that in there. So, yeah, I think it's a great time. And I don't like to put different songs in my set list when I tour. Like this last South America tour I just did was 24 shows. And we opened with Jugulator. We did, you know, Bloodstain, Burning Hell, 101, Hell's Home. We did Hellfire, Thunderbolt, One More Shot at Glory. We did some Iced Earth. But I don't like to put in Judas Priest songs I never sang. I only play something that I've sang. But when we just did the KK's Priest tour, I was mad at first because he goes, let's do Hell Patrol. And I'm like, Ken, I never sang that song. I don't want to do a new one. And then I sang it. I'm like, man, this is awesome. You know, this is great. So listen, I want to make the best songs and have fun and the best shows. And no, I want to do these versions So Ken likes him and has fun with him. And now if he just gets me to fly to England and I do all my vocals sitting here in a little chair, almost like I would be right here. I would sit doing it with my laptop. I would do all the KK's Priest vocals, all the vocals I do right here. Next time I said I wanted some Indian food. I want to come to Wolverhampton, Birmingham, wherever we're doing it. I want some Indian food and a pint. Only one. I'm not a big drinker. A nice pint, some Indian food, and we'll record the next record.
Yeah, I mean, you've worked in the studio with him, so you know what that adds versus doing it separately.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy separate. That last record turned out amazing. Even better vocals than the first one I was singing. But the difference, what I want, I would lie. I mean, I love recording here. I get up, have my coffee, go to the gym, take my time. But it's just the it doesn't last forever, does it? You know what I mean? You know, it's... we're not getting any younger. We're all getting older, and it's like, let's, you know, I'm going to enjoy the opportunity. Do I want to fly to England? I mean, I fly nonstop. No, I just want to have that friendship and to be around and just enjoy a pint, you know, and have AJ come out and Tony and it's, Ken's a fun person to be around. It's different if he was a I'll use that because it's because we're talking about English and I'm going to
Correct.
Australia. So I can use that word. I know there's somebody, a lady in Cleveland, Ohio right now, already penciling me down to turn me in. But he is a fun guy. You just interviewed him. You see what it's like. You know what he's like. He's a super nice guy, and he's fun to be around. He's relaxing to be around. So I want to go there next time, even if I don't get much done, just to have a vindaloo and a pint.
How far, I mean, I know even when I talked to him like last time, you know, for the second record, I know that like it seemed like the ideas at least were kind of taking shape for a third record. Like, how much have you guys talked about the next thing?
Well, I mean, I don't know he's been so busy with so many things. That's my issue. I think him and AJ have probably written stuff. AJ helped write on the last one. Strike of the Viper he wrote, and I look forward to, you know, to start moving eventually. I mean, I'm touring most of this year. I do have spaces where I could do some stuff, but most of the rest of this year, I'm kind of on the road. But recording's easy to do. It's easy to fit in. When they get things done and ready, I come home and record it or go there, whichever it may be. But I keep telling him, just send me a song at a time. I don't care. You know, I want to start working on a new solo record with Jamie Jost. I released Return to Death Row last year, and it did really well. So I'm waiting for Jamie to start sending me stuff, too. So I'm waiting for everybody to send me stuff. But, you know, in the meantime, I just filled up tour dates, and that's got me going.
Awesome, man. Well, here's where I'm going to leave it, and that's just is, you know, you being somebody that has spent so much time with the Priest catalog over the years, like, why do you think this Rockarola album is important in the grand scheme of Judas Priest things?
Well, it got the ball rolling, didn't it? I mean, you went from Ken writing pretty much that record and now to start writing it, and then Rob coming in and Glenn coming in, and that band, the core unit of that band forming during that record. And you can hear the big changes to the next record, but it was the start of it, you know? That was what Judas Priest... that was their vision to start with. And that's what I like. That's what it was. They've always kept, and it's funny. I know they're different. They got heavier. They changed, whatever. They still have that in there. They still have that dual guitar, the Ken's playing, the meat and potatoes of what that Rob sings the same. The meat and potatoes is still there. It's just the song structures, and it got a little bit different. But, I mean, it's their first record, and they're still doing it, you know? I mean... pretty cool.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.